And welcome to Live at Ordinary Miracles with Matt Kramer and usually with my partner, Jan Sircone. Jan's out of town this evening. And this is a program about healing and sound. And my audience just reminded me, turn off your cell phones, folks. We have an audience of one tonight who actually is our guest performer, Maurice Manso, and I'll talk about Maurice a little later. I don't know how many of you are new and how many of you have heard us before, so for the folks that have been here before, please forgive me a little bit of repeat and talk about our show. This is a third show, and Jan and I are both sound healers. In other words, we work with aspects of sound for different kinds of healing. Jan has a process called voice bio, and by listening and recording somebody's voice, you can see what tones are missing, and that you can play those tones as a complement and achieve balance in your physiology. And there's a whole lot more information that Jan can give you about that. And to learn more about Jan's work, you would go to musicforjoyandhealing.com. Musicforjoyandhealing.com. And on there you'll find a link to the music that Jan plays. We opened with a tune from her album, As Above, So Below. That was track 9. That was entitled Seven Sisters. And at the end of the show, we'll go out with another track from Jan's CD. And in terms of sound healing, what I do is something called voice mapping. And if you were to go to my website, which is mattkramer.com, mattkramer.com. At mattkramer.com, you'll see a bunch of websites there, and scroll to the one that says Emotional Healing with Voice Mapping. And you'll learn how the feedback process of the frequencies in your voice being fed back to you can help do some amazing forms of emotional healing. And feel free to contact me if you'd like to talk about that some more. And let's see, we have about 45, 50 minutes to go. If anybody would like to call in, I mean, if you're listening to this show, that means you're looking at the website for VBS Radio, which is a rather amazing online radio station. And let me find their phone number. Toll-free, 877-876-5227. Maybe you're a healer that works with sound and like to introduce yourself to us. We'd like to hear from you. Maybe you have questions about voice mapping. I don't know enough about voice bio, so maybe Jan comes back next week. Talk to her about voice bio. And without further ado, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Maurice Manso. Maury is a writer, singer, and performer. Lives here in Cotati, actually, Sonoma County. But Maury and I probably met about 30 years ago in some town south of Bakersfield that had a whole lot of music business. And Maury used to be in a band called the Sunshine Company. You might talk a little bit about that history. And I invited him here to talk about how music is a healing force. And actually, more if you put on the headset. Okay. Don't want to deny anybody his right to speak here. Okay. Looks good, Maury. How does it sound?
Sounds good to me, Matt.
Okay. So, I don't know if you have a little vocal bio. Why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself?
A little bit about myself. Well, music and healing. When I was 17, I was probably as lost as any 17-year-old, wondering about what to do in the world. And then I met a bluegrass player who owned a Martin D-28. And he was the first one that introduced me to a steel-string guitar, six-string guitar. And from there, he started teaching me to play a little finger style and a little bit of flat picking. And then the first artist that I saw really play the guitar well was an artist named Steve Gillette, who's still around. And I used to go to every club date that I could go to learn what I could learn just by watching, and we became friends. And actually, one of our biggest hits with the Sunshine Company was a song he wrote, which I will play tonight since it was, you know, my big hit way back then.
Paid the rent for a few months.
Paid the rent for a few months, bought him a house in the Hollywood Hills and a Jaguar XKE, but like most rock and roll people, I didn't make any money at all.
I spent
time on the road. But music was salvation for me because it was a means of expression, emotional expression. That's always been my favorite part of music, the emotional impact that it had on me.
Would you say that your audience can connect with that impact when you perform it?
Well, that's what I've been told.
Well, that actually brings up a thought. Would you say in just daily living, it's not as easy to express your emotions as you are able to do in your songs?
Yeah, I find that everywhere. In fact, I spent a great deal of my life trying to figure out how do I become an expressive, emotional person when I'm not sitting behind the guitar playing music. And I'm continually amazed, even today, how many people just stay in their head and are remarkably at a distance from what their emotions are. And I watch them struggling with trying to make this, how do I get this expression out?
You've had that same struggle yourself when you're not behind the guitar.
Oh, for years and years and years and years. In fact, after the Sunshine Company, I played with my friend Greg Allman for a while, played in the studios for a while, got very disenchanted with the music business, and laid down music and just went off to be a man of the world. I moved to Canada and learned about life and went somewhere where nobody knew I was a musician. I didn't tell anybody. Just wanted to see what life would be like without that. And I learned that if I was going to get along, I was going to have to find a way to convey, just speaking, let people know who I was emotionally inside.
Not easy to practice, is it?
Pardon?
To practice that is a challenge.
Yeah, it was quite a challenge. I made a lot of mistakes. Stayed in my head too much and found out it didn't work. Years later, I was in an auto accident and I had a lot of time off. Became disabled. I'm still on disability. But I was 55. I remembered that the average lifespan of a North American white male is 71 years. I did the quick math and decided to go back into music again, only this time with the experience that I had when I wasn't playing music.
And can you somehow express what the difference is? It sounds like there's a few decades in between the two.
Yeah, there were a few decades. It didn't work out well for me to be just a normal person. When I came back to and started playing music again, I had an old friend who knew when I played back then, and I was explaining what I did, and she said, are you crazy? You were born to do this. And I went, yeah, well, I'm a little slow on the uptake, about 23 years slow.
But you're here today.
I'm here today doing it, yeah. The first thing I did was I knew that I'd never been much of a writer, so I spent the last 3 years, and I still write every day, seeing if I could learn how to write. And now, because the thing I really love doing is sharing the music with people, now I'm getting back into performing, and here I get another chance to do it tonight.
Well, speaking of writing, when was the last time you talked to Steve Gillette?
It was about a year ago, because all these companies that were re-releasing old records from back in the 60s, and in 2000, Capital EMI re-released compilations of the Sunshine Company, which shocked me. And then we started finding out that worldwide, because of the worldwide distribution now, that they've sold over 500,000 units of these compilations, which is probably more records than we sold when we were actually, quote, alive.
So you probably get about a tenth of a penny per unit sold or something like that.
Well, when I talked with Steve, the reason that I called him was to find out if he'd been paid because I knew I hadn't been, and we each have 3 songs on these compilations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we're still tracking that down.
A little bit of more insight on Steve. I met him, of course, many years ago when I was working in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And I ran into him again at the Sisters Folk Festival up in Sisters, Oregon, about 2 years ago.
Right.
And you know, he's very warm, congenial, friendly guy. And
yes, he is.
Whatever I did as a nightclub manager back in those days, he forgave me. And But two things. One, that he goes to the Kerrville Folk Festival every year, and that's about a six-week event, as I understand
yes.
it. People go down there and camp, and it's just like hundreds of little jam sessions going night and day, and he just goes there for regeneration. But he also comes out, I don't know if it's every year, but he came out last year to Esalen and did a songwriting camp.
Yes, he does songwriting camps.
Yeah. And that's one of the most nurturing places. If anybody listening ever said, maybe I'd like to learn how to write a song, but gosh, I'm not good enough or whatever, it's a great place to start because you're around musicians, great and unknown, who all basically say the same thing. It's scary, but you just do it. And it's very nurturing and supportive.
Yes.
And I plan to do that one of these days.
In fact, a short story about Steve's salvation. Steve was a great folk singer and a great writer back when I was 17. But then he thought, for some reason, folk music was dead. So he went off to become a writer and go into country music. And he actually had quite a bit of success, but he told me when I talked with him 3 years ago, when I first came back to California, he said that he had come back to California despondent and depressed. He was in a cafe thinking, I'm a failure, I've blown it, I don't even like what I'm doing, I really am a folk singer. And he was sitting at a counter, and he was kind of talking to himself, and a stranger heard him sort of saying this and turned to Steve and said, well, I have the cure for you. And Steve said, what? And he said, oh, I have the cure for your dilemma. And Steve said, well, what's that? And he said, you need to go to Kerrville. So Steve went to Kerrville, and he goes every year. His wife won't go with him because of the sugars and things, and it's camping out. And, yeah, but he goes every year, and he said it just, he found out that all of our old folk heroes are still alive, many of them, and that most folk music didn't die at all. In fact, it's probably bigger today than ever before.
Actually, in terms of the house concert circuit, a lot of people don't know there's something called house concerts.
That's right.
But there's hundreds of them around the country and around the world, and musicians can go and play in a kind of quiet, non-electric, non-commercial environment where the audience comes to listen. And in most cases, I mean, I produce a house concert occasionally myself, we give 100% of the door to the musician, and they can actually make a decent little living playing to 20, 30, 40 people, two, three, maybe four times a week. And folk music is really blossoming between that and the folk festivals.
Yeah, that's right. Steve makes his living traveling around the country 4 or 5 months a year doing exactly that and festivals.
Well, since we're talking so much about Steve, why don't we go ahead and do Back on the Street again?
Okay, I got to change my tuning here. I was going to open up with the song that you like, Words from Your Heart.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about it so we can segue in? Well, go ahead.
Well, I can tune and do Back on the Street again.
Okay.
It'll only take me a second.
It's the magic of radio, folks. And I'll mention that Maurice is playing a beautiful Taylor guitar.
Which doesn't belong to me because I have a great supportive... I'm kind of a poor guy, and I have great supportive friends up here. And one of my friends, when I met him, said... I have a job, I work all the time, I have no girlfriend, I have 2 children to raise and no life, so we started buying really nice guitars, and then I started giving him guitar lessons. Because when I got up here, excuse me, I have a scratchy throat today, back when he was 17, in his 70s, he told me that I had showed him a bunch of music. I don't even remember this. And when he'd been looking for me for a year. And when I rented a house up here, we had a mutual friend. 2 weeks before I moved up, Scott called to see if this guy had any tapes of my music. And this guy said, well, Scott, I can do better than that. He's moving up here in 2 weeks.
Small world.
Small world.
I'm watching the strings vibrate here.
Got to do a little tuning here, folks.
We will not tell any tuning jokes.
Steve Gillette song called Back on the Street Again. And here we go. This is for you, Steve. Thanks for the inspiration.
Back on the
back on the street again. Gotta stand on my own two feet again. I'm walking that lonely beat again. Remembering when, oh, remembering when. Got a tear in my eye again to remind me that I might cry again. Feeling sad and wondering why again. Remembering when, oh, remembering when. I remember a time when I thought the world was mine. The world belongs to somebody else now, and I'm just standing in line. So I'm thinking of me again. That's the way it's gonna be again. I'll wait and I'll see till then. I'm remembering when. Oh, remembering when. And I remember a time when I thought the world was mine. But the world belongs to somebody else now, and I'm just standing in line. So I'm thinking of me again. That's the way it's gonna be again. I'll wait and I'll see till then. I'm remembering when.
And you're listening to Maurice Manso on BBS Radio. Maurice, do you remember writing your first song? How old were you?
I started writing when I was 17. And because I was inspired by traditional music, my first songs weren't exactly what you could call anywhere near original, but I liked them. Shortly after that, I got very lucky and started meeting my contemporaries, and one of the first great writers that I met when I was 17 was Jackson Browne on the day that he quit the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. He was an original member.
What was his mood that day?
Pardon?
What was his mood on that day?
Well, his mood, I'll tell you a great story. Ralph Barr, who was in the Dirt Band and was a guitar mentor of mine, told me that I needed to go to Long Beach that day to meet this person who was going to quit the Dirt Band. And I said, okay, well, that's great. I'll go there. And I pulled up to the Dirt House, as they called it, and standing on the front porch in his underwear, I didn't know it was Jackson yet, they used to have these Helms bakery trucks that would deliver bakery goods up and down the street, and Jackson was yelling at the Helms truck, which was driving by, and finally flagged him down, got the guy to back up, bought a big box full of donuts. I took out my guitar and walked up on the porch and said, hi, I'm Maury Manso. He said, hi, I'm Jackson Browne. Give me 15 minutes. I have to quit this band.
Okay.
So then he came back out, and there was a park just across the street. We went over to the park. We kind of introduced ourselves. He said, I'm a writer, mostly. And so I said, okay, sing me some songs. The very first song that he sang me was These Days.
Which he wrote when he was 16.
Another thing called Time Travel Fantasy and something else. Well, after These Days, we were sitting on the ground. I literally fell over on my back. I couldn't believe that a 17-year-old wrote that song. And from there on, after for about the next 3 years, we were pretty much inseparable because I would insist upon every time he wrote a new song that I would be the first person to hear it. And I used to perform a lot of his material because at the time, Jackson couldn't get a record contract.
Mm-hmm.
And we, several of our contemporaries around Southern California performed his music because we knew he was just such a phenomenal talent.
He must have known Rick Elswit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rick Elswit became a guitarist with Dr. Hook, and he's one of the early guys that influenced me back in the late 60s. And he's one of the first folks I heard do Jackson Browne song.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Do you remember your first song?
The who?
Your first song?
No. Nope.
Okay. Well, tell us about the one you were tuned up to play.
Oh, okay. This is a song that... it's funny how songs come about. I have the great love of my life in my life. We're 400 miles away. And oftentimes she will talk endlessly on the phone until my ears want to fall off, all from her head. So,
any good lyrics as she's speaking?
Occasionally, she's a great inspiration. I've written a lot of songs because of her.
Okay.
And then I have a friend who I'm playing his guitar, and he works all day long talking to customers. So at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he doesn't want to hear much of anything from anybody unless it's from the heart. And so I dedicated this song from him to him. And it's called Words From Your Heart.
Okay.
So I tuned down a little bit here, but... This is called Words From Your Heart. Can be in this conversation here in the middle. nothing. Won't have to do any damn deep translation. Words from your heart. When I'm talking from my mind, it's just a mental display. So what can I say? I'd rather speak from my heart, from my very best part, right from the start. Words from my heart. Then we can be in this conversation, here in the middle of our heart sensations. We won't have to do any deep translation of words from our heart. Yeah, actually, Jackson, on that day we were talking, he said, well, do you write? And I said, well, yeah, I write a little bit, but, you know, I'm not too happy with it. And he said, well, you know, he said, and I played him a couple of my first songs. And he said, well, you know, that's really quite lovely, but I see what you mean, that you're not happy with it. He said, but it's in you. So you just have to really open up, and he said, just give it up, Maury. Give it up, you know. Let it out, and just keep doing it. It'll happen. That was a lesson I learned from Jackson. And of course, I got to hear every new song that he wrote, well, you know, and play them. And I sort of saw what he was doing, little bits of what he was doing, you know, how things were constructed, kind of got an idea of where he would take his idea and make that into lyrics. So
I'd say around 1971, I was living in Hollywood, and Jackson was dating my roommate.
Oh.
And he still didn't have a record deal, although I think he was close.
Yeah.
And he'd come over and pick up my guitar, and he'd play these pieces of songs.
Uh-huh.
That he was still working on.
Right.
You know, you say Jamaica.
Right.
You know.
Jamaica say you will. That's what that became, yeah.
Right. And that, well, you know, in the songs I was writing, certainly did not inspire me. And so I wound up putting my guitar down and going backstage instead of on stage. But a kind of a version of what you just said is, you know, over the years when I've run many nightclubs and had to do a lot of kind of talent coordinating,
yeah.
And anybody in both the music and the film business knows, and we're not trained for, most of us in that field of dealing with talent, the main thing we do is say no, and very few people know how to say it gracefully and with respect.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And often one of my bigger challenges was I would get a demo tape or hear somebody play, and technically they were very proficient.
Yeah.
Nice voice, played well.
Right.
Songs were, you know, competently constructed, but just didn't really touch me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I learned is most people stay within boundaries and they stay safe. And if they're staying safe and they're maybe kind of trying to make the record companies happy and stay within guidelines, you know, they're not going any place dangerous.
Right.
But it's going someplace dangerous that often provides the most excitement and often touches the most honest chord.
Right. Yeah. Well, you think about these days. Talk about opening yourself up wide open. You look at the lyrics of those songs. If we have time, maybe I'll even play it tonight. Because another thing I learned about writing over the years is I used to think these things used to just spring out of Jackson like magic. But I noticed that he would be constantly doing rewrites. Change a little word here, leave out a verse, write a new verse. And I started realizing, oh, yeah. And in fact, the first guy that I played music with, his name is John Bettis. He became a very successful lyricist. And I used to do demos for him at A&M where he was a staff writer before he had his big hits with the Carpenters and Michael Jackson, of course, Human Nature. And he told me, and when I was still writing back then, hey, if I even finished a song, I never touched it again.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Maury, I live on rewrites.
Yeah.
So that was another great lesson. And I do that all the time, too. I mean, the heart version usually does come out pretty complete for me now, but I spend a lot of time rewriting and asking myself, am I getting across what I want to say? And I think if we had more time and people could hear the rest of my songs, they'd see that, yeah, I'm pretty willing to be vulnerable and open myself up. And actually, the only thing that any of us have is our story. And so when
right.
we hear songs that are contrived and constructed to be a hit in the music industry, it often leaves us cold. We might like the beat, we might like the tune, we might like the record, we might like the voice, but it's just another record. And then there are those special songs that really touch us. Usually they're very vulnerable.
Actually, I remember a conversation with Dino Arelli many years ago. He was with Shelter Records. And this was many years ago, and he said, you know, when I was a kid, listening to the radio, what we would sing along with was the voices. You know, if it was Nat King Cole's voice or if it was
right.
Elvis's voice. And the other day I'm listening to my 15-year-old kid. What he's singing along to is effects.
Uh-huh.
And so it was not about anything human anymore. You know,
right.
it was what kind of tricks and what kind of production is going to give that
right.
that slick hit feel. That
Yeah, it's interesting, the music business, you know. I got a record contract by fluke, and all of the people that had record contracts were taking Jackson's music to our record company saying, this is the person you should sign. They all said one interesting thing. Great writer, the guy can't sing. And I thought, where are your ears?
Is this before Bob Dylan?
Yeah, I was after Bob Dylan,
yeah.
actually. And, you know, but actually Jackson did take vocal lessons.
Uh-huh.
And that really freed him up. He used to strain a lot. When Jackson used to sing, it used to look like the cords in his neck were kind of, I thought he was going to have a coronary. You know? So.
You look like you're about to play something.
Yeah. This is another song that came from the same person of Words From Your Heart. My friend, the guy that lets me babysit his really nice guitars. And I have wanted to perform, but I've been writing so much that I don't get out and do too much. Well, lately, he was kind of bugging me, so I went and did this open mic night that's kind of opened up everything for me. And I was telling him, yeah, I'm going to go to this open mic night. And he said, are you really? I said, yeah, I'm really going to go. And he said, well, it's about time. And I said, okay, well, honestly, I'm going. And he said, okay. And then later we were talking, and he said, no, what I meant, Maury, was, meaning my life, it's about Time.
Uh-huh.
So this song is called About Time, and that's where it started, and there you go, Scott.
Okay.
And this is something I feel that there's some kind of, especially, excuse me, maybe it's only Sonoma County, where there are a great many musical artists. And we all feel called. Many of us are older. Many of us didn't do music for many years. And now all of a sudden we feel that we're needed. We're supposed to do this. Every one of them has an emotional impact in their music. It's not a contrivance. As Hoyt Action used to say, people would ask him, hey, what kind of an act is this? And Hoyt would say, it's not an act. This is called It's About Time. Matt, should I move this vocal mic down or am I crap?
Well, say it again.
Should I move the vocal mic down?
No, you sound fine.
Okay, great. Here we go. It's about time. Live radio, folks. Live radio, folks. By the way, hello, world. Time. I heard someone say, it's about time. It's about time. Oh, it's about time. So how much time are we gonna get? If I were you, I wouldn't want to bet on time. No, not about time. Life goes by, time runs on. It might go right, looks like it's going wrong this time. Maybe one last time. So one day I woke up, opened my eyes, opened my ears, I heard the whole world cry, it's time, oh, it's about time, oh, it's about time, oh, it's about time. I can doubt that when the sand's in the glass and the sands run out, then it's time. Oh, it's about time. And the sands will run, and maybe they won't. We can't say do, and we can't say don't. About time. No, no, not about time. Time to die, time to live. It's better to be living. Well, there's time to give to our world. Oh, and it's about time. Oh, it's about time. You know, the earth warms the people. Well, the ice runs out, Greenland melts, and some people shout, hey, give me a drink, and forget about it. 'Cause we're out of time. But it's about time. I hear other people say, things could be better than they are today. There are ways. Well, there's still time. So, oh, it's about time. Oh, it's about time.
come forward, woman and man, with love in their hearts and help in their hands in time. Well, it's about time. Time is calling out for us to stand up with eyes of vision and hearts of love. It's time. Yeah, yeah. It's about time. Me, I'm standing here in my own time, singing my songs and beating out time, 'cause it's time. Oh, it's about time. So it's about time. I heard someone say it's about time. Oh, it's about time.
It's About Time, written and sung by Maury Manso. And speaking of live performance, let me take a little non-commercial break here.
Okay.
We're broadcasting live from Ordinary Miracles.
Yes, we are.
In downtown Cotati, Sonoma County, California. I know that listeners are all over the world with internet radio. So if you don't live in Sonoma County, it's a great place to come take a vacation. And on September 30th, here in the store, we're going to have a lot of music, live music, performing. It's a two-part performance called Songs of Sonoma. It begins at 3 o'clock with songwriters in the round. And on September 30th, Maury Manso will be performing along with Claire Victor and Rick Taylor. And then at 4 o'clock, we have a concert set with three folks from Alaska and one from Seattle. From Alaska, it's Tom Begich and Terry and Jerry Holder. And our friend Joel Tepp will be coming down to sit in with them. And Joel and Maury and I all worked and played at the Troubadour back in the 70s. So it's an interesting little cycle and circle of homecoming. If you'd like more information or you want to get on the email list, you can email me. Email matt@mattkramer.com, mattkramer.com. I'll answer any question you have. And, Maury, I was curious about the transition going from folks like Jackson Browne and Steve Gillette to working with Greg Allman.
Yeah.
What made that leap, and what was that like?
Well, I didn't realize how successful the Sunshine Company was. We were never, you know, your number one record hit, but we opened for every great band that was number one. The Doors, Jefferson Airplane, oh my God, Canned Heat, Paul Butterfield Blues. I mean, just everybody. We had this wonderful chance to meet a lot of people. Well, our manager managed three acts: Steve Martin, the comedian, who's another good friend, the Dirt Band, and the Sunshine Company.
That was Bill McEwen.
That was Bill McEwen.
Right.
And, well, the Dirt Band was on tour. They were a one-hit wonder in L.A. Of course, they're history now. I mean, they're in the Country Music Hall of Fame. But, they were down in Macon, Georgia. They went into a bar, and they saw a band called the Allman Joys. And this was a very young Greg Allman, probably too young to be in the bar, and his brother, Dwayne. And the Dirt Band told Bill, "Oh, my God, you need to come hear these guys." So Bill brought them out to Hollywood. And part of the Dirt Band and the Sunshine Company lived in a place called the Mikado Apartments in Hollywood. And Greg and Dwayne moved in. And they had a group then. They changed the name to the Hourglass. They signed to the same record company we were with. But nothing happened with the records. However, this was one of the greatest white rhythm and blues dance bands you ever heard. And Bill Graham used to hire them at the Fillmore. They were opening acts for lots of festivals and things. And people that were in the know that were lucky enough to happen to see them live, because they had no record success, were just amazed at what was going on. So we all became friends, and especially Greg and I, because we were just about the same age. So we were doing our fourth album for Liberty Records. We had recorded, before George Harrison released it, Something, a version of that. We recorded Hoydax and Snowblind Friend. We showed the first two things to our record company, those songs. They said, well, two things. Nobody can cover a Beatle tune. 3 months later, Joe Cocker covered Something. They said, Snowblind Friend is a drug song, but it's an anti-drug song, and you can't do that, and so we quit. We were frustrated with the music business. Well, here's a little inside story. Sorry, Duane, I'm going to tell a secret on you. Duane was fed up, and Bill McEwen had bought them a lot of equipment. Probably don't know this story, Bill, because here's what you got told. Duane came to Bill one day and said, oh my gosh, I was in Denny's, and I had the van parked outside with all the equipment in it, and somebody stole it. Well, years later, Greg told me, no, Duane sold the van, sold all the equipment, and bought a ticket to go home down south. And that's when he started playing in the studios with Aretha Franklin and
so on. Met Dickie Betts.
And met Dickie Betts, right. Well, Greg and I then were bandless, and Greg still owed the record company a record. So my old bass player and drummer and myself and Greg decided, well, we'll form a band. And that's when Greg began to write songs that were pre-Allman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
He brought on another guitarist from down south. First one, his name was Petey Carr, but he was too young and crazy. He became a famous producer for ATCO later. So he brought on another wonderful guitarist named Tippy Armstrong. And we were actually predecessors of the Allman Brothers band because Tippy was a wonderful lead guitarist. I was just learning that, but I was a good rhythm guitarist. And Tippy said, well, now, let's not just do leads. Let's think of ourselves as a horn section because we were doing white rhythm and blues stuff. And if a lead needed to be taken, Tippy took it and was teaching me lead guitar. And we rehearsed for a year. We did one gig, but there is an album recorded with 12 finished songs. And just as we were about to end the gig that we did, we played the same 13 songs, and it was a dance place with 750 people, and we were mobbed. We opened for Blue Oyster Cult. It was a great band. Great band. And Greg got to be without his brother and just really blossom. So just as we were about to finish the album, and we had Johnny Sanford from Sanford Townsend Band singing harmony with Greg on the record, Greg called Duane and said, oh my God, Greg, Ahmet Ertegun at Atlantic Records just gave me all the money in the world to put together a band. Come on home. Greg came to us and said, oh, man, I'm in a dilemma. I just got this call, but I've been rehearsing with you guys for a year, and we're great, and we're just about to release this record. And we said, Greg, go home. And he actually was crying. He said, but I can't leave you guys. We've been working so hard. And we said, Greg, go home. And the rest is history.
And where's that album?
Nobody knows. We have some acetates. My bass player still does. They never pressed it. I don't know why anybody hasn't discovered it, or else if they did, somehow legally Greg squashed it and didn't want it released, even though it's a great, pretty darn good album.
Now, I promised you could sing four songs, and we're supposed to go to instrumental break in about 2 minutes.
Okay.
So, do you have a song you'd like to close with?
Yeah, I'll close with it one. We got 2 minutes to do it? It's longer than that, so maybe I shouldn't.
No, go ahead.
Okay. This is a song called Holy Land. This comes out of the Bible. One time somebody asked Jesus, Jesus, where is the kingdom of heaven? And he said, verily, verily, I say unto you, the kingdom of heaven is within you. So, here it goes. Holy Land. Well, we say we are going to the Holy Land, but there's no destination, no promised land. The kingdom of heaven, it's in the heart of man, it's in the heart.
heart of man. We are standing in the holy land. Oh, you don't have to go to Mount Zion. You don't have to keep on trying, because we are standing in the holy land. But we say we are following God's commands issued from the mountains and the desert sands. If we listen to our own small, still voice, we'll understand that we are standing in the holy land. Oh, Jerusalem, I'd set you free, but in your heart, you gotta see that we are standing in the holy land. Oh, we are standing on solid ground. No matter where we are, the whole world round, the whole world round. Yeah, we are standing on holy ground.
And we're going to fade out here. And
but we go chasing all around.
We're going to bring Maury back someday. We want to thank you all for listening. And Seth, if you're listening, we will turn the radio over to you. And we're going to go out with an instrumental from Jan Sircone's album, As Above, So Below. Thank you all and good night.
Because we are standing on solid ground. Yes, we are. Oh, we are standing, we are standing, we are standing in the holy land.